It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, why are some of us left-handed and more of us right-handed? Turns out the science behind that simple difference is pretty complicated. We'll look at that and other science news with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. First, Wisconsin's Republican Party convention just wrapped up, and one of the big questions was who would get the party endorsement in the Republican primary race for U.S. Senate? State Senator Leah Vukmir is competing against businessman Kevin Nicholson, and when the delegate votes came in Saturday, Vukmir won with 73% of the vote. But it's still a long road to the primary election in August. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be with you.
Well, people are watching these Republican primaries in a lot of states around the country. We just saw some high-profile ones in West Virginia and elsewhere. Do you think that we here in Wisconsin with this primary are getting that same kind of national scrutiny?
Well, I think that maybe not quite yet because they're focusing on the primaries that are going on right now. But I would think that as the summer progresses, if in particular this U.S. Senate primary heats up, that there'll be a lot more national attention come August.
When we look at these two Republican candidates, they're both aiming a challenge, Democrat Tammy Baldwin, the incumbent, do you see a lot of space between them when it comes to actual policy differences? Are these two people who would vote differently on the Senate floor?
I think they're both pretty consistent in terms of their being Republicans and conservative Republicans, so I don't see much of a difference in that regard, actually.
So we see a lot of differences around the country. One candidate shaping up as the sort of establishment candidate, one trying to portray themselves as the outsider. Do you see that shaping up in this race?
Yeah, absolutely. And you referenced the West Virginia primary last week, and we clearly had that going on. Same thing in a primary in Indiana last week, and we see the same thing here. So Leah Vukmir actually referred to that when she spoke at the convention about the so-called establishment, and Nicholson clearly sees himself as the outsider and more in that Donald Trump outsider drain the swamp mode.
With this convention support for Leah Vukmir, is this something that really is going to make a difference in, 3 months when the actual voting happens in the primary?
I think the fact that she won the endorsement so handily is important. I think that what this will do is encourage the county-level political organizations, which do a lot of the on-the-ground work, to be more focused on supporting her and getting her name on party materials and things like that. So I think you can't discount the idea of the message coming from the party activists that she is the person, by far 73% is a high number, that the party is supporting. So I think it does have some tangible benefits on the ground.
We're talking to UW-Whitewater political scientist Susan Johnson about the Republican primary and the race for a Wisconsin U.S. Senate seat. Leah Vukmir, Kevin Nicholson running against each other, hoping to challenge Tammy Baldwin come November. So that's the party organization, Susan. There's been a lot of attention to the financial backing for both of these candidates, quite a bit for Leah Vukmir. Kevin Nicholson getting a lot of support from Richard Uihlein from Illinois. He's not going to have any shortage of funding, it sounds like.
No, in fact, the most recent quarterly reports that would have come out just about a month ago showed that as far as cash on hand goes and as far as the amount of money that had been raised in the first quarter of 2018, Nicholson was ahead in both regards. And as you mentioned, Nicholson has received a lot of support from people outside of Wisconsin. And I don't know if that's going to continue, depending on how things go over the summer. And as we start to see more polling and things like that, we might begin to see some of that back away, but we haven't seen any indication of that so far.
Each of the Republican candidates has gotten some pushback for recent comments or campaign ads. Kevin Nicholson questioned the cognitive processes of veterans who ended up voting for or running as Democrats. That's gotten some pushback from Democrats in the state and nationally, particularly Democrats who are veterans themselves. Is this something that is going to be a problem for him in a Republican primary?
I don't know that it's going to be a problem in a Republican primary, although there have been some Republicans who have come out and said that they would not have said the same thing that he did. but I don't know that anyone is going to make their voting decision in a primary based on those comments.
And then State Senator Vukmir, she had an ad up saying that Tammy Baldwin, Senator Tammy Baldwin, was on Team Terrorist for her opposition to a CIA nominee, her picture next to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the 9/11 plotters. And that even some Wisconsin conservative groups had pushed back on that. Senator Ron Johnson said he wouldn't have said that. Is this something that could be a problem for her either in the primary or in a general election?
Well, again, in the primary, I'm not sure, even though, as you said, Senator Ron Johnson indicated he would not have done this, and also Right Wisconsin and others have said that this probably wasn't the best thing to do. However, in the general election, I could see, should Nicholson or Vukmir get the nomination, that these comments come back and be used by the Democratic candidate, Tammy Baldwin, to show, I would say in the case of both, to show that they're a bit, let's say, extreme or outside of the mainstream, as Tammy Baldwin tries to portray herself as being a sort of a mainline Democrat. So I could definitely see these coming back in the general election.
And let's turn to that general election now. I look at, how the national political rating people do things, and some of them say, yeah, Wisconsin is a vulnerable state for Democrats. This is a place where a Democratic incumbent could be beaten by a Republican. I know it's early, and I don't ask anybody to predict things, but what are you watching for to see if this is, in fact, a vulnerable seat for Democrats?
I'm watching what goes on in terms of the primary for the GOP nomination, but I'm also looking at the governor's race, because that is going to be perhaps more prominent on people's minds as they're thinking toward the November election. And so I'm going to want to know who the Democratic nominee is going to be for that party, and then also how strong Governor Walker runs, because people come out to vote based on their enthusiasm for those kind of top-of-the-ticket positions. And I think the governor's race might in some way kind of drive turnout, and so that might have an impact on who actually wins that Senate seat.
And Susan, can you talk about what's at stake, how important Wisconsin's Senate seat is in the overall contest to determine which party is in control of the Senate?
The Democrats they very much want to hold on to this seat. The map for the Democrats, they're going to be defending a lot of Democratic seats in states where Trump won quite substantially in 2016. So this is one that they feel that if they have any hope whatsoever of getting the majority in the Senate, they're going to have to hold on to this seat.
And one of the consequences of control of the Senate I wanted to dig into, it's been in the news a lot lately, the ability to confirm or not confirm appointments of federal judges at various levels. People focus on the Supreme Court, but Court of Appeals on down, it's a big deal. Can you talk about the role of the Senate and how important that is?
Well, sure. The Senate, as you said, confirms federal judicial appointments. We talk about the Supreme Court a lot, but there's, hundreds and hundreds that serve on lower federal courts. And what we've seen is that President Trump has been quite successful in getting his nominees through and getting their seats on the bench. And so I would think that that would be one of the prime motivating factors for the Democrats to pull out all the stops in hopes of, in fact, picking up the majority in the Senate.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at the Republican primary race for a U.S. Senate seat here in Wisconsin. Right now, it's time for a monthly check-in with Discover Magazine for the latest science news. The further north you travel, the more the landscape changes visually and beneath your feet. As you get closer to the Arctic Circle, the ground becomes permafrost. As the temperature rises globally, this frozen land is starting to thaw, and that could have unintended consequences. Then throw out everything you ever thought you knew about being right or left-handed, and we learn about some exciting news about one of our evolutionary cousins. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello and happy science to you, my friend.
To you too. And there's some happy science news today. Big news out just a little while ago today. These guys, Homo naledi, already one of the most interesting sort of evolutionary stories out there of the last few years. Give us some background on these guys before we talk about this new news.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about Homo naledi, there's a lot that's amazing about this particular hominin. And basically, the more we find out, the more intriguing it becomes. Back in 2013, paleoanthropologists in South Africa discovered this site almost completely inaccessible, deep in a cave system. And they found not, you know, the human fossil record, tons of fragmentary finds, maybe one mostly complete individual, but at this site, they found at least 15 individuals present. And since then, they found an additional Homo naledi site. So they have all these members of Homo naledi all found together. And the actual anatomy of this hominin is really fascinating because it's a blend of very early characteristics and much later characteristics. And one of the things that really intrigued people was the size of its brain. Its brain seems very small for its body. So in addition to all the other things, all the other questions swirling around Homo naledi, the question was, well, how does it work? How does it get around? What did it do? What was it capable of with a brain that's less than half as big as the modern human brain?
And it looked like in this cave, and that's a whole story that we've talked about on the show before, how these Homo naledi were found and how they needed tiny, skinny people to crawl into these caves and actually get them out. John Hawks, a UW researcher, connected with this. Anyway.
Absolutely.
But the idea is, okay, these guys, they could have had a really small brain, but they were doing something really on purpose. It looked like they were placing their dead in this obscure place in certain ways, but that didn't seem to add up with the brain size. So that takes us to this new news today. What are we seeing?
Yeah, that's right. And just to recap a little bit, their small brain volume made a lot of people think that they were just not cognitively capable of processing the idea of intentionally placing your dead. And I have to say, there's still a lot of controversy over whether they actually did that. That's just one theory, and there's a lot of critics of it. But one of the things the critics kept saying was, oh, they have a tiny brain. They couldn't have done it. But what today's research reveals is that their brains, yes, they were definitely smaller. They were less than half the size of modern human brains. But structurally, their brains had a lot of what we think of as advances in later members of the genus Homo, including ourselves.
How do they know that? Because, right, there aren't brains left over in here. It's all bones. It's all the hard stuff. So how do they figure out how complicated a brain was?
Exactly. They're able to take what are called endocasts, and basically it's an impression of the inside of the skull. And, you know, in life, there are a few layers of tissue between the actual brain and the actual skull, so it's not an exact imprint. However, they have enough of these endocasts from other fossil hominins, from members of living species, including other primates. They've got enough of them to have a really good idea of what an endocast can tell us about the actual brain itself. So when they made these endocasts of several Homo naledi specimens, they discovered that there are certain structures in the brain that you don't see in other primates like apes and chimps. And you also don't see them in Australopiths. And they are the earlier hominins, the earlier members of our family, like Lucy. Everybody knows Lucy. She was an Australopith. But Homo naledi, a lot of people expected that because the Homo naledi brain is about as big as an Australopith's, maybe a little bit larger, everyone expected to find a similar structure to those earlier, more primitive species. However, their structure, again, much more advanced. It's got several particular features that have really long names that I'm not going to say on air because they'll take forever and I'll say them wrong. But anyway, they could tell structurally that it has a lot of the features that later members of the genus Homo, including you and me and everybody listening, we have them, and they are specifically features that control things like planning and communication and tool making. So now they're thinking, because their brains were smaller but more advanced, maybe Homo naledi was capable of all these more advanced cognitive tasks that people just kind of wrote off in the beginning.
And one question, this is cool, this tells us more, kind of tantalizing too. Are we starting to figure out where they fit in on our family tree, if I can be Homo sapiens centric here, how they're related to us?
Yeah, and you know, one of the really interesting things that has come out since 2015, when Homo naledi was first described in the scientific literature, at that time, in 2015, they could not definitively say how old the species was. So a lot of people thought, oh, it's really old. It's one of those bridges between Australopiths and the genus Homo. Really old, whatever. But then in 2017, they found out that these the specimens are only a couple hundred thousand years old. So what that means is it looks more and more like Homo naledi was kind of this offshoot on the family tree where they existed much more recently than we would have thought. Another example of that is Homo floresiensis, better known as the Hobbit in Indonesia. And that's another example of it. It seems like these, what we see at face value, these perhaps more primitive hominins, they were around at the same time we were. And they just evolved in this different direction for whatever reason. It obviously gave them some kind of evolutionary advantage in their environment. So it's again, this interesting kind of modern relic issue in our family tree. No one is sure how closely they are related to us in particular. That is still up for debate, but there's so much happening in the field and so many new connections found that I think in a few years we're going to find out more about how closely related we are to them.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, checking out some of the coolest stories in the world of science. Some stuff that is cool, but not as cool as it should be. Gemma, permafrost is supposed to be frozen year-round, year after year, more and more. It is thawing, and this is bad news, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm not laughing. I'm laughing at your pun.
At the pun. Oh, yes. Yeah.
At
my ill-timed jape, yes.
But yes, this is very bad news, and it's very bad news for a lot of different reasons. Some reasons people may not think of. Everyone, I think, kind of knows there's a ton of carbon stored in the permafrost. So as it continues to thaw, researchers across the board expect the carbon to be released, no longer to be stored in the permafrost, but released into the atmosphere, which is, you know, we don't need that to happen, let's just say that. And I think it's important to remember what permafrost is. It's,
yeah.
It's really basically defined as ground, and that could mean rock, it could mean soil, it's some ice. It's a lot of organic material, animals and plants that have died, but also tons of archaeological artifacts, things like pieces of clothing that are thousands of years old, they're actually finding preserved in the permafrost. So it's all this organic stuff in addition to the rock and the soil and the ice. And the definition of it stays frozen for at least two consecutive years. But in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere, the permafrost has been frozen for hundreds of thousands of years. So now that it's thawing, that's where all the problems are arising in a lot of different ways.
And one of those, some people are, you know, have built cities on permafrost, and now that could sink in. And also, this surprised me. Permafrost is a great place for viruses to survive, and they think outbreaks of things like anthrax in animals may be thousands of years old viruses.
Yes, yes. In fact, a couple of years ago, researchers isolated two viruses from 30,000-year-old permafrost deposits, and they woke those viruses up in the lab very easily. And so it is true that there is a lot, you know, there are victims of smallpox and plague and the 1918 influenza pandemic. There are, again, victims of anthrax, and they're all in kind of the upper levels of the permafrost, the active layers, and it is very possible. In fact, just a couple of years ago in Siberia, there was an anthrax outbreak that they think was the result of thawing anthrax victims that reinfected living people. But the real danger, if any of these diseases were to pop up, it's bad. But we kind of know what to look for, and they're hoping that quarantine, modern treatments, they could contain it. The researchers' real fear is that with mining operations and other industrial operations going deeper and deeper into this permafrost, they're worried that they're going to find and reactivate, say, a 600,000-year-old virus that we have never seen before and that we have no weapons to fight. That's their big fear. And it's scary stuff, I'll admit. It's not a fun thing to talk about, but it heartens me somewhat that there are researchers looking at this very seriously and trying to figure out what to do about it before it happens.
All right. Well, on a less scary note, Gemma, you wrote about why you're left-handed and why I'm right-handed, and it may not be the reasons we used to think. Why?
There's nothing scary about that. Left-handed
right.
people are just better than everyone else.
Right. And you used to fence, you wrote, and I fenced briefly, and wow, it was hard fencing against left-handers.
Yes. You know, it's great. As a fencer, all I had to do was stand there because it's, right-handed people have a huge disadvantage in fencing. But in any case, for years and years as a southpaw, I was told, the right side of your brain controls the left side of the body, so only left-handers are in their right minds. Ha-ha. Well, that's not true at all. I was taught by nuns who often reminded me that being left-handed was a sign of the devil. Also not true, thank you very much. And they're finding out, for example, left-handedness, it doesn't even start in the brain. It appears that it starts in the spine. And when the embryo is only about 8 weeks old, they're already showing a clear preference for left over right. And paleoanthropologists are doing studies, really fascinating studies, looking at scrape marks on teeth. And they think they can figure out who was left-handed way, way back in our family tree. Neanderthals, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, maybe even Homo naledi one day. I don't know that they've done that particular analysis on Homo naledi, but we're finding that left-handedness just turns out to be natural variation, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything. And in fact, it doesn't even mean you're going to be super smart or smarter than the average right-hander. So it's just, kind of like blonde hair versus brown hair. It's just a thing, and all you right-handed people have to get used to it because we're not going anywhere.
Very briefly, Gemma, I think the weirdest fact that I've learned from you in all this time was in this piece. We tend to be right-handed. A lot of animals, they don't show a preference, or you just can't tell. Kangaroos tend to be left-handed?
Yeah, certain species of kangaroo are definitely left-handed.
How do we know? Like, what are they doing? They're throwing their softball left-handed? I don't know.
That's the paw that they punch you with when you bother them.
Well, I shan't be doing that then. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us around this time every month to share some of the coolest stories from the world of science. First, if we think about the most creative, innovative places in the country, rural areas may not be at the top of our minds, but some new research finds that innovation and new ideas are finding homes in rural areas of the United States. Our next guest says Silicon Valley and other metropolitan areas don't have a monopoly when it comes to creativity and innovation. Richard Florida is a co-founder and editor-at-large of City Lab, senior editor at The Atlantic. He's a professor of business and creativity at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. His recent piece in City Lab is called The Rise of the Rural Creative Class. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Let's talk about this idea, first of all, that, the innovation, the creativity is coming from urban areas and not rural areas. Where does that come from?
Well, I think it's just a long-running myth. And, in urban affairs and in urban studies, or when people think about cities, whether they read Jane Jacobs or not, the late great urbanist, they think of creative centers, they think of, a Florence in Italy, or they think about London or Berlin in Europe, or they think of New York City and this outpouring of art. Big cities that were good, like Chicago or Pittsburgh and Detroit in their day, or the San Francisco Bay Area in our time, that were great at innovation or forming startup companies. And I think in the popular mind, less so than the academic literature, in the popular mind, innovation and all good things like that are associated with bigger, larger, more populated, more economically robust, and more diverse cities.
And you've written a lot, and before we dig into rural areas, I want to get into a core concept of yours from your book, The Rise of the Creative Class, this association between innovation in an economic sense, in a business sense, and creativity in what we might think of as the more artistic sense, performing areas, that kind of thing. Connect the dots for us. We're losing Richard Florida now. We're going to reconnect in another way. We're talking to Richard Florida, author of The Rise of the Creative Class, talking about rural communities and creativity. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What's going on in your area when it comes to artistic creativity, performance, theater, art, music, whatever you want to talk about? And do you see that translating into business innovation, creativity in an economic sense? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. As we get Richard Florida back with us now, it looks like. Richard, sorry about that. We lost you, but we've connected another way. Let's start that question again. Connect the dots for us between artistic creativity and innovation in an economic sense.
Yeah, well, sorry to listeners out there. This is the hazards of the internet age.
Definitely.
It makes all of this easier. Sometimes it makes it harder. When I was a younger person studying innovation, people said, well, innovation comes from R&D labs. It comes from scientists and techies. It comes from university research centers. And the more I dug into this, I could see that the places that were defining the centers of high-end, high-tech innovation in the U.S. economy, the San Francisco Bay Areas, the New Yorks, the Bostons, the Seattles, they weren't just high-tech centers. These were places with thriving music and artistic scenes. So we did some research and did some data analysis, which found pretty conclusively that metropolitan areas, on balance, large, small, medium, 350-plus metropolitan areas in the United States, on balance, the places that had the highest levels of innovation or startup companies or technological advance tended to have, all other things equal, more thriving artistic, music, and design and creative economy. So I dubbed this group the creative class. It's not just scientists and techies and entrepreneurs and innovators, but it's artists and musicians and designers. All told, about 40 million Americans occupy that class, about a third of our workforce.
Now bring that into a rural area or a small town that wouldn't have been on that list of 350 metropolitan areas. Does that connection still hold true?
Well, even more so. And again, this is not my research. There is a group of people in the U.S. Department of Agriculture who are spectacular researchers. And 15 years ago, when Rise of the Creative Class came out, wanted to try to replicate these findings. So one thing they did was actually come up with a tighter and more robust definition of my own creative class using new data. But the other thing they did was try to figure out, in rural communities, to what degree does this creative innovation economy connection hold? And what they found is, if anything, it's stronger. For one, they found, just like with the economy generally, innovation is not evenly spread across rural America, just like it concentrates in urban America, in certain cities more than others. It is concentrated in certain rural areas more than others. They document about 100 of what they call rural creative magnets across the United States. But the thing they find is, in terms of whether you look at new product innovation or more continuous process innovation, The level of that at the rural in America, controlling for other factors like size, is about the same as in urban America. But moreover, this innovation and creativity in rural America is much more closely connected to arts and cultural creativity. In other words, to make this simple, in rural areas, if you have a thriving arts and cultural economy, the odds are even better than in urban America, you will have a highly innovative business economy.
What is happening there? Why does that happen? Is it that, okay, if I'm a member of this creative class in the business side of things, I want to be in this area, whether it's urban or rural, where there's cool stuff going on?
Well, there are several factors which they find up the odds. One is if you have a great university in your area or close by. Second is if you have a close connection to a big metro, either relatively close by air, or even better, if you're a rural area out in the periphery, like the Hudson River towns outside of New York, which have become hotbeds of creativity. But this arts and cultural connection was more important than any of those. If you have nonprofit arts organizations, if you have for-profit arts organizations, if you have art galleries, if you have working artists, and we know in America, as much as there have been urban artists, there have long been artists in America, in California, in New York, in Colorado, throughout our heartland, who have preferred to live in rural areas. So why? The most obvious explanation, and the explanation I've written about in urban areas, is that when you have a thriving arts and cultural community, like a Greenwich Village or San Francisco's Mission District or Haight-Ashbury area, we can go on, that attracts different, diverse, bizarre, strange, out-of-the-ordinary, weird people. And because those places attract out-of-the-ordinary, different-thinking, strange people, they have a climate that's open to different-thinking, strange, out-of-the-box entrepreneurs. So mine was a kind of a latency argument. There was a latent tendency in these places to be able to attract the artist and, you know, the musician like Jimi Hendrix, the entrepreneur like Bill Gates, the musicians like the Grateful Dead and the San Francisco scene, and the entrepreneur like Stephen Jobs. But what these researchers at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in particular a fellow named Tim Wojan, find, it's more direct, that there is something in the rural communities that when they have a strong arts and creative community, it alters the way those communities think. It puts a premium on design-based thinking or on innovation-based thinking. It's not simply the indirect effect of attracting talented and ambitious entrepreneurs. It's much more that the way of thought and the way of thinking and the way of doing businesses in those rural areas changes, and that's what they conclude drives their higher level of innovation.
But what I'm thinking is, if I'm in economic development, state level, county, local, whatever, what do I do with this? Can I do things to make my local rural area, my small town, more creative, or do I just have to hope we get lucky and the right convergence of people just happens?
Well, first of all, it says what not to do. So let's not pull up a dump truck full of money and give that dump truck full of billions of dollars to Foxconn or to Amazon HQ2. Let's not take that dump truck full of taxpayer money and give it to a new football or baseball or AA or AAA stadium or arena. What it suggests is making very small bets in very sticky place-specific assets. So, at the margin, natural amenities matter. Making sure that your bike trails and hiking trails and mountain biking trails are well-groomed. If there are small arts organizations in your towns, helping to support them, perhaps by giving them a little bit of public money, a little bit of maybe help, perhaps by helping them convene benefits where they can raise more money, by supporting, even through local government, local musicians, giving them a place to play, letting them play at local events and charitable events or local government. It really means doing very small things that benefit your community instead of these big silver bullet approaches. And what these researchers show is support for small-scale arts organizations, support for small-scale musical organizations, support for the nonprofit community and the arts and cultural community. That is adding more value to the rural economy than it is to the urban. You would think just the opposite. Oh, my God, we're not going to have nonprofit arts organizations and art galleries and musical places in the rural community. No, that's city stuff. What this research shows is that is the stuff that really matters to the rural economy, and it's not big bucks. You know, so my view on all of this is stop wasting taxpayer money with the silver bullet solutions and the big bucks, and do the small-scale stuff that matters. And by the way, that goes triple for state-level economic developers. For state-level economic developers, who are the ones really loading up the proverbial dump truck with incentive dollars, really trying to give the big bucks to these big projects, what we call the elephant big game hunting. For them, doing these small things throughout their states that matter seem to have a much bigger payback. And you know what else? It's very interesting. It didn't only show that it paid off in terms of innovation. What's so interesting about this research coming out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture is that it showed in the communities that did that, people had a better feeling of well-being. They were happier in their town. They had higher levels of civic engagement. So it kind of made their town a better place for everybody, not just for the innovators and the companies that were racking up these innovations, and maybe by dint of it, a little higher profits and better wages for their workers.
Richard Florida is with us, co-founder of City Lab, professor at the University of Toronto. We're talking about his recent piece called The Rise of the Rural Creative Class. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see that thriving local arts or music or other cultural scene in your community, your rural area of the state, your small town? Do you wish you did, but you don't have it? What do you think your community, the state, should invest in to create this sort of hub of creativity? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Richard Florida from City Lab, professor at the University of Toronto, talking about his piece on creativity in rural communities and the economic benefits of having a creative culture, an art scene, a music scene, whatever it might be. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you watched a Wisconsin town, your own, or maybe one you visit, grow to be more creative? What signs of creativity have you seen in rural Wisconsin, maybe in your part of the state? Do you think it is worthwhile to invest state money, local money, into things like arts? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Richard, wanted to ask you about how the schools fit into this. Do things like arts and music education play a role in what you're talking about?
Well, I think so. It's unclear from this research that we were talking about, but I can give you a case that helps make the case. In American popular music today, if you study this, and I love popular music and I love popular culture, so I do, you will notice that among the great hit makers, there is a preponderance of Swedish surnames. Many of the great hit makers, I mean, writing hits not for indie bands, but for Taylor Swift or co-writing with Katy Perry and Lady Gaga, are these hit makers from Sweden. And then there's been New Yorker articles. There's been a book written about these fellas. Well, you know, in Sweden, 30 years ago, the Swedes had a massive program to expand art and particularly music education in their elementary and high schools. And it's no coincidence that as a result of that, many, many, you know, brilliant Swedish kids were trained in music and got the music bug. So, yeah, it makes great sense. And on another hand, you know, I'm a kid who, believe this or not, folks, I always hated school. I always hated studying. I never liked to go to school. I know that sounds odd for somebody with a PhD. I'm a guitar player. What did I like to do when I was a kid? Play rock and roll with my brother who was a drummer and play in a band. I still, to this day, feel more comfortable in a music shop or playing with a guitar than I do in a bookshop or a library. You know, Bill Clinton said this. You know, he realized at 17 that he wasn't going to be the next second coming of John Coltrane. I realized about the same age I wasn't going to be the second coming of Jimi Hendrix. But the point is that music stokes the passion of so many young kids that are bored by other stuff. And you know, not just in urban areas or in working class towns like I grew up, but in rural areas all across this country. So, one, I think there's a direct connection, you know, arts and music education, they're big industries. You can go on and do well in them. But two, I think there's an indirect connection. It stokes your passion. It makes you interested in stuff. It keeps you going on the good path. And it gives you some skills. You know, for me, it gave me public speaking or public engagement skills that I wouldn't have otherwise had unless I was in a band.
I want to bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Mazamani. Nate, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just want to reinforce what the speaker is saying, because I've lived in the Mazamani, which is a community of 1,600 people, it's grown gradually over the 47 years I've lived there. But it's been a community that's had a civic pride and a commitment to engagement in the arts. They've had their own drama company, a local music group has emerged in the last decade. The community provided has a lot of public space, buildings, and has provided a place for that music group to perform once a month. They also have a lot of parks that have been developed by the Lions Club, and I helped clean the creek with a bunch of volunteers from the community, and with a little money from the village. We also have some nice trails that have been developed.
Nate, I'm going to jump in before we run out of time, but Richard, he's hitting a lot of the notes. It seems like Nate's happy with these changes. Community provided space for performances, maintaining those trails and natural areas. Mesa Maney doing a lot of what you're talking about, it sounds like.
It sounds like our article and the research that I wrote about in Microcosm. I mean, they're doing what the people at the USDA says works across thousands of communities. And one other thing, you know, you had mentioned local and state economic development. Nate said something powerful. It's not just city and state. It's local public-private partnership and local civic organizations and local community people and nonprofits. So I think we also have to rethink when we say economic development. It's the Lions Club. It's the local civic organization. It's local arts group. It's citizens. It's a business, and, you know, helping out with space when it's not occupied. I think that's what's really been key to the turnaround in America. Where that happens, where that local civic culture is ignited around arts and other things, that's where you begin to see success.
Thanks for that call, Nate. Rich, in our last couple minutes, a concern we hear a lot in Wisconsin, especially the smaller communities, rural communities, is how do we keep our kids here? How do we keep them from moving away? In our last minute and a half or so, is that part of the puzzle too?
Well, I think kids are going to move away, and I think they're going to move away to go to great colleges, and they're going to move away to those big labor markets, whether that's Milwaukee or whether that's Chicago, for that first job. But the question is, you know, those cities have gotten so expensive, in many ways so common, I don't want to call them generic, but you know what I'm saying, that when people get older and they're going to raise their kids, they're looking for something real. The other thing we did not talk about is the research that's coming out. Rural areas are not just better places to raise kids because they're safe and the kids feel more at home and they can play outside. We're finding that in terms of upward mobility, rural places actually, in many cases, offer a better pathway to upward mobility over time. So let the kids go away. Let them go off to college and get that first job. But when they get a little older, make it an attractive place not only for them to come back, but for lots of kids from other towns to come and make a place in a smaller town or a rural area.
We'll leave it there. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure being with you. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Richard Florida, co-founder and editor-at-large of City Lab, senior editor at The Atlantic. He's a professor at the University of Toronto. He's known for his work and his books about the creative class. We've been talking about his recent piece in City Lab called The Rise of the Rural Creative Class. Still time for you to weigh in, maybe on what's going on in your community. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Is there a local effort, a local theater group, something like that, a new thing going on in your town, in your part of the state that you want to give a shout out to? Tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. You can also send us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is the creative community rising in your rural part of the state, your small town? Let us know. It is spring produce season. There's a lot of good stuff coming into farmers markets, stores, farm stands, and CSA shares. There's asparagus, yay, garlic scapes, ramps, rhubarb, herbs. But there's one that shows up in my CSA bag that I just can't use. It's called lovage. It's a green or an herb or something, and I just can't make myself like it. And I've tried. And do we all have that one veggie that we can't learn to like? Jay Carlisle Larson, Central Time producer, has one. Hey, JC.
Oh, yeah. I'm about to bust out with a very unpopular opinion. I really hate cucumbers.
Cucumbers.
I hate cucumbers.
Now, I think of cucumbers as sort of the beige of the vegetable world. They're not exciting, but they're really inoffensive. They're like a standby in our house. Oh, what's our veggie? We've got no time. Cut up a cucumber.
Absolutely not. I cannot get on board. I can't abide by that. I just don't like the flavor. You know, I don't know what it is.
Oh, you know, we don't usually cook them in our house. Are you like frying them up or something?
Oh, you know me. I just love fried cucumbers.
Because we usually just eat them raw. That's what you do too? Or what you've tried, I should say?
I've tried. I mean, yes, I've had them raw. I can't imagine a hot cucumber. To me, it doesn't sound very good.
I think
because
Laurie
I don't
Skelton
like
had a
cold
thing
cucumbers either.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I hope that I get mocked for this, but I am not a fan at all.
You tried. I brought in that lovage today. Thumbs up or down?
That was very much a down, but
still
I really
tasting
tried.
It hours later.
I am still tasting it. It took a coconut seltzer water to try to get it out of my mouth.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.